Beginning this four-part series on the Brahma Viharas, what I want to do this evening is to lay some of the groundwork for kind of the historical context, the folklore context for the Brahma Viharas, where in the Pali Canon and other Buddhist texts these teachings are actually to be found, what their origins are, how they've unfolded down through the ages. And then on our successive gatherings, you know, the fourth Sunday of this month and the first and third of December, we are going to be inquiring more precisely into some of the other Brahma Viharas like compassion, selfless joy, and equanimity. And we'll be doing some guided meditations around each one of those. Also I forgot, in terms of Dharma-related activities, on the evening of November 23rd, I got invited to go to Regis College to participate in a kind of a colloquium of government, business, and spiritual leaders on operationalizing the Pope's encyclical on the climate. It's at 7 o'clock at Regis College on that Monday evening, I think it is. So you're all warmly invited to attend. It's open to the public. It is.
Did you say Sunday the 23rd?
I think it's Monday the 23rd.
Regis.
Regis College, 3333 Regis Boulevard, I think it is. There'll be lots of other folks there also sharing their views, but it should be an interesting evening. Bill Ritter's going to be there and some other folks.
Could you be sure the specific address gets there? That's a big campus. It's easy not to find.
Yeah, what I'll probably do is put out some kind of a notice on our listserv with the relevant information. Okay. So this evening there are three areas that I want to touch on and that we can talk about a little bit. The first is described in the Pali language and in this tradition as bhavana. And bhavana translates, as the Buddha used this term, it means cultivation. It means actualizing, okay? Bringing into being that which is potentially existent in the consciousness. And so one of my own teachers, Ajahn Amaro, when he talks about the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas, he speaks of them, that's the actual phrase he uses. He said we have these, in the Mahayana they call it seed consciousness, that we have these what he called potentially existent seeds within our consciousness that, given the right conditions, will germinate and come forth and bloom and come to full fruition. He in turn, of course, got that imagery from the Buddha, the dude. So what I want to do here is to read part of a Dharma talk from one of the Thai meditation masters, forest meditation masters in this tradition, who was in turn a teacher to some of my own teachers and others in this tradition, like Jack Kornfield, for instance. His name is Ajahn Chah. And in his Dharma talks on bhavana, on cultivation, and now for the last month, we've been looking at the cultivation of mindfulness, right? How to go about cultivating the meditative qualities of mindfulness, concentration, you know, finding the right kind of effort. And so that's what we're talking about here a little bit this evening. What is the appropriate or wise or skillful kind of effort to put into cultivating these qualities of mind? The Buddha taught that this process, which is to say spiritual development, spiritual evolution, matures at its own rate. Having reached this level of practice, we allow it to develop according to our innate capabilities, our spiritual aptitude, and the merit we've accumulated in the past. But we never stop putting effort into the practice. Wherever the whether the progress is swift or slow is out of our control. It's like planting a tree. The tree knows how fast it should grow. If we want it to grow more quickly than it is, this is pure delusion. If we want it to grow more slowly, recognize this as delusion as well. If we do the work, the results will be forthcoming, just like planting a tree. For example, say we want to plant a chili bush. Our responsibility is to dig a hole, plant the seedling, water it, fertilize it, and protect it from insects. This is our job, our end of the bargain. This is where faith comes in. Whether the chili plant grows or not is up to it. It's not our business. We can't go tugging on the plant, trying to stretch it and make it grow faster. That's not how nature works. Our responsibility is to water and fertilize it. Practicing the Dhamma in this way puts the heart at ease. If we realize enlightenment in our lifetime, that's fine. If we have to wait until the next life, no matter. We have faith and unfaltering conviction in the Dharma. Whether we progress quickly or slowly is up to our innate capabilities, our spiritual attitude, and the merit we've accumulated so far. Practicing like this puts the heart at ease. It's just like that chili plant we're nurturing. Give it water and fertilizer, it will do the job of absorbing the nutrients. When ants or termites come to infest it, we chase them away. Doing just this much is enough for the chili to grow beautifully on its own. And once it is growing beautifully, don't try to force it to flower when we think it should flower. It's none of our business. So, sort of the faith to let go, you know, the realization that we do what we can insofar as our own spiritual maturation is concerned, insofar as the development of wisdom into why we are the way we are, why we behave the way we do. Okay. We do what we can, and then it's a natural unfolding process. That's what the Buddha tells us. So when I was starting out with the study and practice of the Dharma, I had some quite kind of boot camp style ideas about how it was supposed to work, you know, and the vigorous discipline and the devotion and the effort and whatnot were all was going to really needed. And if I wasn't progressing, whatever that means, as fast as I thought I should be, it was just because I wasn't a good enough yogi and had to try harder. Right? Which of course began after a while to lead to a certain amount of doubt as to whether or not I just didn't have quite what it took, or whether I was kind of barking up the wrong Dharma tree or whatever. And then it was coming across teachings like Ajahn Chah's that gradually caused me to realize, you know, we do our part, we do what we can. And then there was a period of time when I said, oh, screw it, I'll just sit here like a lump on a log and see what happens, you know, and kind of tried kind of the Barca Lounge style practice. And somehow that didn't seem to quite get it either, you know. The Buddha's talks about wise or appropriate or skillful effort had to do with, you know, kind of finding that middle path somewhere in between. Because I had this idea, well, if this is all my spiritual birthright and it's all supposed to happen naturally, I shouldn't have to do these practices. You know, I'll just become happier and more loving and compassionate all on my own, right? Well, there are some reasons why it doesn't work like that, you know. And so what I had an opportunity to do is to say, okay, if I just kick back and do nothing, then not much happens. And I don't feel like there's movement or growth happening. Okay. And it was just because of what Ajahn Chah was talking about. And on the other hand, if you find yourself in a striving state of mind and a lot of self-judgment comes up, if you think your practice isn't measuring up to where you think it ought to be, that's what Jack used to talk about in terms of the ego wanting to be around for its own funeral. You know, it's like the discursive mind is trying to do stuff that it wasn't designed to do, you know, which is why I can't do it very well. It can point you in the direction of where these teachings lie and where you might go and get some experience, you know, with practice and inculcating them into your own consciousness. But that's about as far as it can take you. Other than that, after that, it becomes a matter of just this kind of deep spiritual inquiry and reflection. And so it is with the cultivation of these qualities of the heart-mind, you know, of loving-kindness and selfless joy, equanimity, and compassion. They certainly do lie within us, waiting to be discovered, waiting to be nurtured. You know, in Zen there's a lot of talk, Suzuki Roshi has this sweet little Dharma talk on what he called mind weeds. And he would talk about how, you know, it's if you're gardening, you need to learn to be pretty good at identifying plants, the ones that you want to nurture and that you want to grow there, and the ones that you really don't. And so the ones you really don't, you pull them up and you thresh them and you chop them up real fine, and then you put them back into the ground as mulch. So he said, just through this careful observation of what's coming up, that's the kind of effort that we're talking about here. So you find a lot of the Dharma teachers, just like the Buddha himself, you know, he lived in an agrarian society, and he would talk about, you know, being in partnership with yourself. Okay, being a spiritual friend to yourself, a kalyana mita. You know, when I've actually heard this practice, when one was asked, well, what's the goal of why are you doing this, you know? It's for the purpose of becoming better friends with yourself. So, in this practice of the cultivation of loving kindness, there is been some buzz or debate about whether or not you should focus first on yourself or whether it should use you to all beings. And the Buddha was pretty unequivocal on this point, actually. I'm not quite sure why there's as much buzz about it as there is. The gist of my talk this evening is going to be a mix of what the historical Buddha is actually thought to have said in the discourses, and some of the kind of the folk tales that surround it, some of the sort of folk context that's grown up around it over the time. And there are certain characters that appear again and again in the discourses, and there are people that the Buddha would have periodic conversations with. And somebody was around and heard the nature of their talk and you know, was committed it to memory and then eventually got committed to writing. So among the characters that would show up a lot were King Pasanada, king of Kosala, and his wife, Queen Malika. And King Pasanada was he was one of these kind of warrior kings, one warlords basically, that was out there vying for real estate, you know, and trying to conquer their neighbors and become the next level warlord up and so on and so forth. And he was coming back from a battle he'd just lost once, and he found this this young woman who was the daughter of a gardener. She made leis, you know, she made garlands. She would take flowers and make garlands out of them, and had this really calm, friendly demeanor, even though she was living in fairly, in very modest circumstances in this kingdom that was always under threat, and there was a lot of stress and whatnot going on. He was very taken with her. The texts say she was also easy to look at, and so he got up with her. Even though she was a commoner, relatively uneducated, he took her into his household and married her, made her queen of the kingdom. He was really taken with several aspects of who she was, including the fact she seemed to be really smart and very insightful, even though she was quite uneducated and quite the spiritual seeker. And so she was invited to go hear a Dharma talk by the Buddha at one point. She was extremely impressed and came back and told King Pasanada. And so she invited him to come along and listen to one of these talks as well. Could see that he was very inspirational, that the Buddha was really on to something. And so King Pasanada tells the Buddha, well, why don't you give me some advanced instruction so I can teach my wife and my household about this? And the Buddha said, well, it's not really how it works. How it works is that somebody who is highly qualified to teach the Dharma can come and do that. I'll lend you Ananda, who's my sidekick, you know, my kind of my wingman, number two guy. And so Ananda came and visited the household, the palace of King Pasanada and Queen Mallika, and he gives them Dharma instruction. And it turns out that she is quite gifted and has this really deep intuitive understanding of the Dharma. And so a lot of the discourses or the interactions between King Pasanada and Queen Mallika and the Buddha have to do with King Pasanada saying, okay, well, no, the way I understand this is this, you know, and he kind of lays it out. And then Queen Mallika says, well, I think perhaps, and the Buddha always says, yep, she's got it. So it's a kind of interesting little interplay because she's one of these really dynamic and powerful women in the Theravada Buddhist texts, which there aren't too many of, actually. But she is one of the ones who props up again and again as knowing exactly what the Buddha was talking about, knowing exactly how to put it into practice in the life of the kingdom. And so, in this one instance that's talked about here in the Udana, thus I have heard, on a certain occasion, the Blessed One at Savanti in the Jade forest, in the park of, it was living in the park of Anapitakinda. Now at that time, the King Pasanada Kosala, in company with Queen Mallika, had ascended to his principal palace. And King Pasanada said to Queen Mallika, do you, O Mallika, love anyone better than yourself in this world? And he had this expectation that she was going to say, oh yes, my lord, it is you I love above all else. Well, she didn't. Instead, she said, no, great king, I love no one better than myself. Moreover, great king, you do not have any, you do not love anyone better than yourself, do you? And he said, I too, O Mallika, love no one better than myself. And King Pasanadi descended from his palace, went to the Blessed One, and drawing near, saluted the Blessed One and sat down apart. And while thus seated, he said to the Blessed One, just now, sire, I ascended to my principal palace in the company of Queen Mallika, and I said to Queen Mallika, do you love any better than yourself? And she responded, no. And basically what he was trying to get at was, does she have it right? It sounds to me like she's being a little stuck up here. And what the Buddha said was this. And reflecting on those words, I have visited the four quarters in my mind, just to say he allowed his consciousness to expand, to examine all beings throughout the realm of the universe, right? He said, nor did I find any more deserving of love than myself. All beings hold themselves dear. This being true, whom then can harm another? So what he was trying to get at here was, of course, you know, this is all the four quarters in my mind, nor found I any more deserving a love than myself. Okay. Each holds himself dear. Which is to say, if we're kind of mentally well, then we care for ourselves, we care for our own well-being. Okay. So in the Buddhist context, rather than talking about issues or concepts like esteem, you know, high self-esteem, low self-esteem, you know, that somehow or another you got to figure out how to crank it up to just the right level or something like that. Whether it's high self-esteem or low self-esteem, they're both products of the discursive mind. So instead of talking about self-esteem, high or low, what the Buddha talks about is self-love, self-compassion. But not as apart from any other living being. Okay. Not better than, worse than, same as. When he speaks about self-love, he's not talking about me being hot stuff. He's talking about me being just as valuable as every other living being in the world. And for that reason, we should cherish ourselves. So he was pretty clear about the cultivation of the practice of metta flowing from within like a fountain. Okay. That it fills our own being. This is the imagery actually used in talking about the cultivation of deep states of samadhi. You know, it's something, this potentially existent state of mind arises from within our own consciousness, and we are imbued with it, okay? And then it flows outward just like a fountain because it wants to be shared. Not so we become a source of that that's manifesting in the world, just like others are becoming a source of it that manifests in the world. So when he talked about the cultivation of metta, you know, he said it's something that we do for ourselves, and it's something that we do for each other. And that ultimately the two are not separate. Okay. So it's a somewhat different take on the way when we use terms like, you know, high or low self-esteem. It's a little bit of a different take on it, because those terms, and they certainly have their uses in terms of psychotherapy and your understanding of how your mind works and whatnot, but they also frame the situation in such a way as it still kind of implies separateness. You know, it's like taking your car in for a tune-up, you know, go to the therapist, and I need a self-esteem tune-up here, you know, do you have any affirmations or something I can do here to kind of crank it up a little bit or wind it down a little bit. And in fact, in Buddha Dharma, it's not such a useful or relevant concept, because it's not about I and me, it's about we, and how we're all worthy of being cherished. And that our ability to do that is, insofar as our relationship with others, is intimately associated with our ability to do it for ourselves. So whenever we find ourselves not doing that for whatever reason, that immediately becomes a very worthy object of meditation and inquiry. Okay. Not self-condemnation, but simply inquiry. Okay. How is it that my mind is working in such a way right now as to give myself a hard time? What's happening there, you know? If there is some kind of subtle sense of, you know, better than, you know, some other being, you know, like Joseph Goldstein, when he's talking about practice of metta, he said, when you hear your metta phrases, you know, being, when directed to another, you know, may you cease your annoying behavior. it indicates that you don't quite have it right yet. Because that's not, you know, that's not us together, that's judging. Okay. So a little bit about the centrality of kind regard for oneself as a kind of the basis for being able to genuinely sort of share this with others. Any questions so far about that? Either about cultivation or about self-love? Yes, ma'am.
So why is there a debate about the self-love? And where is that coming from?
In the view of some, the problem with starting the focus there is that it can too easily lead to self-reification. That, you know, you are dispensing metta to those who don't have it as together as you do, right? That you're kind of starting off from that point, and that that it should be a selfless gesture that's always kind of projected outwards. But the other thing that happens is that over the years, even within the Theravada world, you know, Southeast Asia or Southern Buddhism, the forms that are been held for the last 2.5 millennia in Sri Lanka and Thailand and Burma and Cambodia. There are also the Buddha, the literal language the Buddha taught when he taught the Brahmaviharas, he just taught about the sharing and spreading of these qualities of mind and the four quarters. By that he meant like sort of throughout the universe. About 1,000 years after the Buddha lived and taught, on the island of Sri Lanka, there is a vast monastery of monk scholars, okay? And there was a kind of a author, a cleric, recorder, compiler among this, in this great monastic university setting named Buddhaghosa. And what he did was to pull together all of the experiences that the monks had over the years practicing the teachings they found in the Pali Canon, which is the first written transcripts of what the historical Buddhas actually thought to have said. And in so doing, they came up with this set of advice that is kind of a user's guide to the Pali Canon. And it, the path of purification, okay, is the English title of the book. And it was in that book that you find this formula that the monks there came up with. And it's the book, the Pali words, Vasuddhimagga, the title of the book. And they came up with this formula. They said, well, just exuding all these things in the four directions, that's a little drifty. So what they did is say, we think it works better if you start off just with another person, you know, your spiritual benefactor, somebody you're really grateful to for your spiritual maturation, and then a dear friend, somebody, and then somebody that doesn't move you one way or another, and then maybe somebody who's a little hard to be with, okay, and then on out to the greater world. And so that kind of interpersonal progression of teaching metta actually comes out of the Vasuddhimagga, out of this. Yeah, please, Don.
Well, it seems to me that the notion here of starting with self is an easy one for Asians to do, because, and you know, that's the idea, start with the easiest object.
Yes.
And for Asians, in the Asian tradition, that would be the self. There isn't that kind of self-loathing there that exists here. In a society that where individual ego is sort of not given much, you know, I mean, what I'm saying is in Asian societies, after millennia, individual identity is actually not given much value or emphasis,
mm-hmm.
if you will. So it's easy in the Asian tradition to start with the self, especially if you're coming at it from the perspective that there isn't a self.
Yes, right. You're quite right.
Context. There is no personality.
Yes, context is everything. The Dalai Lama and Sharon Salzberg had pretty much exactly this conversation. When she, because she had been a student of the Burmese method, you know, and the Insight Meditation Center in Rangoon, studying with Mahasi Sayadaw and Pandita. And so when she came back and started teaching metta in the West, she was kind of focusing on starting with the self, and the Dalai Lama said, sure, but it seems like you spend a fair amount of time working on yourself first. Why is that? And she said, well, because a lot of people in the West hate themselves. And he couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, she really had to, he was really quite, he had no place to put that. You know, it's a well-known conversation, actually, that that he just could not understand this phenomenon of people having such negative self-regard. And that she was saying, that turns out for me in teaching metta, just like you said, you know, different from Asia, of being something I really need to focus on a lot because it's so difficult for people. And so a lot of times what folks would start doing is just kind of, oh, I'll get back to myself, you know. It's a lot easier for me to kind of do this for others. But what happens when you start trying to develop a metta practice in that way is that it has no foundation, and it starts to feel kind of artificial and brittle, and eventually it has no vibrance, it has no real life to it anymore because somebody's missing. But it's an excellent point, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, please.
And it seems like the part of the cultural problem is, especially the Christian tradition, when they talk about original sin, and you're born a sinner, and you're born basically transgressed before you're even born, and so you're not raised to think of yourself that way.
It's what Sharon Salzberg refers to as being spiritually wounded. You know, any tradition that you're born into that teaches that you are somehow or another fundamentally flawed, and you need to be healed, and it can only be through the grace of, you know, an external omniscient, omnipotent deity that this happens, creates this great cleft, and this, you know, it basically instills very deep self-doubt. And so, yeah, it's part of our kind of cultural heritage, I guess. That all that being said, I have had Sangha members from some traditional Asian Sanghas come to me and say, I can't really go to that Sangha anymore because when I went to the monk and asked, you know, why I was having such terrible problems, you know, domestic violence and whatnot in my home, he said, oh, it was because of things I did in a past life. And, you know, I just had to meditate harder or something, you know, grin and bear it, sort of. So it's possible to have persons in positions of authority in just about any religious tradition that can kind of put that kind of spin on a teaching. But certainly, you know, we seem to have certainly inherited our share of it here. Yeah, please.
I just recently saw an article, I don't know if it was in the New York Times, about Jack. Did you hear about this, Sharon and Joseph? And the debate about that was that they put a Western psychologist spin on Buddha Dharma with this kind of, you start with yourself and the fear and loathing of the Westerners. And so there's debating that that was never in the Buddha Dharma. But is it? I mean, and that's what the article
just read that out of your diary.
I was really interested to hear what you had to say about that because it mentioned all three of them, bringing Western psychology into the world.
Well, Jack, more than the others, he's got a PhD in psychotherapy, but And, but there are a lot of, you know, that Jack used to joke in a lot of those early retreats in the 70s that, you know, that half the people on any retreat were psychotherapists and the other half were their patients. So this whole psychodharma thing really, you know, really kind of took hold, and there was a real worry that Western psychotherapy had kind of appropriated the Dharma in that way. And there is, you know, there's a whole realm of therapy now that usually goes along with cognitive behavioral therapy called mindfulness. You know, it's a modality now, you know, of teaching mindfulness meditation in a kind of a secular format within the psychotherapeutic context, which is why I usually make sure to read this, that particular passage, because it's basically, you know, scriptural refutation of that view that the Buddha never taught the importance of loving oneself, because he certainly did. And then the story of how the Metta Sutta first came into being is also kind of an interesting one. If you've ever had occasion to visit in Thailand, or you've looked at photographs of, you know, street scenes or whatnot, you'll see that certainly among the more traditional homes and pretty much throughout Thailand, whether in cities or out in the rural areas, a great many of the homes, perhaps the majority of them, at least the traditionally designed ones, have out by the front gate or near the front of the entrance to the home a little thing. It looks kind of like a dollhouse, but it's basically a pretty accurate or pretty good replica of the house itself, kind of like an architect's model of the home. Okay, it's usually there on a post and near the entrance to the home. It's called a spirit house. And there's an important reason why that tradition exists, and it is this, and it has to do with the story about where the Metta Sutta came from, which is this, that the Buddha's spiritual communities here and there around India were getting more and more established, and there was one monastic community that was kind of on the edge of the wilderness, where there was bustling and it was robust and active, and a lot of people were coming there to study the Dharma and practice, take robes and whatnot. But some of the monks who were practicing there were of the view that things are getting a little soft, you know. There's too much distraction. I really want to do deep samadhi practice. We need something more severe and more ascetic. And so they asked the Buddha's permission to go off into the boonies, back into the jungle, and set up a more kind of primitive camp where they would, you know, place even heavier strictures on themselves in terms of hours of sitting and walking practice and eating less and all that kind of thing. And so the Buddha said, yeah, sure, go for it. And they went out there and they set up this kind of little Buddha boot camp out in the outback. And all went well for a few days. Of course, now the tales about the Buddha and these main characters in the suttas all are based upon the worldview of the time and the religions of the time. And in each of these rural areas, animism was a big deal, just like it is in Thailand and Burma and other Southeast Asian countries even today, especially among rural peoples. And so they are very much of the view that they're unseen beings, forest spirits, who inhabit the environment. This there, right? Beings unseen. And that at first these unseen beings, the forest spirits, were delighted that these monks had come to practice, you know, really, you know, kind of nice to have them hanging there for a few days and spreading goodwill and, you know, getting down with the Dharma. But then the forest spirits evidently thought they were just kind of camp for a little while and go away, but they didn't. And so the forest spirits got very perturbed at them for not honoring their existence and not recognizing that they were kind of displacing them. And so the forest spirits began to torment them. They would replicate the sounds of wild animals at night, and they would appear as apparitions. And the monks got more and more anxious and more afraid, and they kept this up, and they were all having nightmares, and it was just turning into a hell realm. And so finally the monks all gave up, and they ran screaming back to the Buddha and said, "No, this is terrible, you know, we went out there and the forest demons attacked us and they were driving us insane, we had to come back." And what the Buddha said was, "You know, there's really not a whole lot you can do about what's going on out in the world. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my, you know, you bet there's things out in the jungle that'll eat you if they have half a chance, you know. Or for that matter, what you consider to be these malevolent spirits." He said, "The only thing that you can do about it is to conquer fear with love." And so it's in that context that he taught the Metta Sutta. You know, "Whatever beings there may be, both seen and unseen, may they be happy. May they be peaceful. May they be free." And so the monks went back out into the forest to the same place, and they sat down, and they started doing metta for the forest spirits. And then, of course, all was well. But it was essentially the Buddha's advice on overcoming fear. And it goes to this question of who's afraid, right? Yeah. What, fear for your own existence, whether it's your physical existence, fear for the continued existence of yourself, right? Okay. And as long as you're contracted and fearful, you are unable to fully engage the world, you know, like that Spanish gypsy proverb, "A life lived in fear is a life half lived." So the Buddha said, turn it around. Open your heart to that which you fear, and it will be dispelled. If you see these images, you know, the Thai images of the Buddha, sometimes usually standing and holding his hand like that, right? That's the mudra of dispelling fear. It's also kind of sort of a gesture of the sending of metta, right? So as we kind of enter the holiday season and we start kind of like those blow up snowmen and stuff that they put on the front lawns, like we're blowing up our compassion and blowing up our joy and blowing up our, you know, open heartedness, you know, it's like, it doesn't really work quite like that, you know? So that's not quite the effort that we're going for here. But it is to say, as we begin to pay attention to the possibility of the cultivation and the strengthening and the actual living of our lives in this way, it is, these are incredibly valuable teachings, and they can really in-tune us in a pretty powerful and meaningful way to the spirit of the season, whatever that is.
So where does the spirit house connection come in?
Because whenever a house is built now in Thailand, it's with the understanding that they are displacing the spirits that used to live there. And so what they do is they make them a little home to live in, to honor the fact that they are, that the owners of the home are now physically inhabiting the space that used to belong to the spirits. So it's this very frank acknowledgement, you know. And if you have occasion to read the text of the Karaniya Metta Sutta sometime, may all beings be happy. You know, all beings, short, tall, average, beings both seen and unseen, beings now alive and beings yet to be born. Okay. So I really like that phrase too, though, yet to be born. What that means is that for 2,500 years, people in Southeast Asia have been sending us metta, which may have something to do with why we're even here. Why the Buddha even washed up on Buddhism even washed up on Western shores again.
There's an interesting story that came out of Europa, as a matter of fact. They were building an extension, or a new building or something, on campus, and nothing was going right. And they consulted a lama who said, you need to dig holes in the earth and put gold, jewelry in there. And so they put the word out, and people donated rings and things. They planted their gold, and by God, the project went forward. It hadn't up until that time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, to propitiate the spirits of the land.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
And I know I've told the story more than once in here of one of my most dearest Asian teachers, Sister Dipankara, who taught deep samadhi practices, was very much in demand. She lived in rural southern Burma for much of her life, and she was much in demand there as an exorcist. And she had she was also just a brilliantly accomplished metta teacher as well. And so when a little village was being plagued by something, you know, all the goats dying or, you know, or illnesses, or just the well gets poisoned or something, you think the village was well aware it was seriously getting messed with. And they kind of suspected they know who it was, like the spirit of some by that died under mysterious circumstances, or that they had been treated badly and then was coming back to rough everybody up. And so when we think about exorcism in the West, it's the, you know, it's the priest with the cross, and, you know, what she would do is she'd be invited to one of these villages, and she would go in there, and she'd sit down in the village square at midnight and start doing metta practice. And she would be doing metta specifically for the troubled spirit that was thought to be causing the problems. And eventually, that spirit would manifest. And she would be in conversation. Why are you in pain? You know, what is it that's on your mind? How can things be made right? And then in the morning, she'd gather the villagers in and say, okay, this is what I learned last night, you know. But she was doing metta practice toward the disturbed spirit and then inviting it to tell her. And this is, you know, she is far and away one of the most truthful people that I've ever met. Right? So, you know, she wasn't pulling my chain here, anybody else's. I mean, she was telling the truth as she knew it, you know, and how things work in these rural animistic societies and cultures in Southeast Asia. And so she would then inform the villagers, yes, it was so and so, and, you know, they were severely troubled for this, that, or the other reason. And she or he could be honored, and this could be made right if you take the following measures, do the following things here to honor this person's passing. Sure enough, she was much in demand, so it must have worked. Yeah, please.
I'm not sure if this is a spirit house.
Looks like one, yeah. There are, you know, in lots of Asian cultures, they'll put like ceremonial kind of altars and whatnot. A spirit house is usually a very faithful replica of the structure that it's in front of. Yeah, yeah. Please, Ken.
Is your impression that the metta working in the case of the villagers was by changing the villagers?
You know, in my very limited understanding of these things, you know, I've spent some time with some indigenous cultures here in the American West where, you know, you've recounted similar stories. I don't really think it's kind of an either or, you know. I think there's probably is something to this business about beings both seen and unseen. Certainly where the Buddha was coming from and where people like Sister Dipankara come from, or Ajahn Jumian, he's a native healer and Thai meditation master in the south of Thailand. I think it's not outside the realm of possibility that there's something going on in both planes. You know, that there really quite possibly was something in the way of some kind of a troubled spirit that wanted to be heard, that wanted to be acknowledged, that wanted to be honored. And then, of course, her message back to the community, which was, you know, this person felt ill-treated, you know. Whether or not you treated her illy is, or badly is something only you can know. But if in your heart you may have, she could use your metta, she could use, you know, you're asking her forgiveness and something like that. So at the very least, it helped people make peace in their own hearts, this person. So, you know, from the kind of psychological standpoint, that would certainly work insofar as the villagers were concerned. But, well, you know, William James, when he would speak about radically altered states of consciousness, you know, he'd say that these mind states no doubt have their realm of applicability, though we may not know what it is, you know. At any rate, James said, it precludes our closing all accounts with reality. I think it's probably is worth keeping an open mind, you know, and all these teachings that, you know, are can be talked of, thought of as, you know, the teachings on rebirth, for instance, for, you know, in Asia, that's literally taken to mean what it says. Whereas here, there's a kind of a different spin that tends to be put on in terms of the continuing rebirth of self in this lifetime. You know? So whichever way you look at it, it's about, you know, we tend to place a quantitative matrix over reality, right, over time and space, cut everything up into little squares. And there are other ways of knowing or interacting with the world that don't include that. And this may be one of them. Simply worth keeping an open mind. I've also had enough experience working with people who are dying or had recently died to feel that there's something we don't have a theory for yet that's out there. So, I guess we should have had this talk on Halloween instead. About out of time, why don't we settle in and sit for just one more moment. May all beings live with ease. Safe from all inner and outer harm. Free from all physical and mental affliction. All beings who walk the earth and live within it, fly in the skies above and swim in the waters below. All beings now alive, all beings yet to be born, all beings both seen and unseen, all beings in all the realms of the universe. May we all be happy, may we all be peaceful, and may we all be free. Thank you. Get together in 2 weeks and talk about compassion.